These were not our wolves. Their heavy, white-furred backs rose to the height of my waist, and pink tongues lolled out of their jaws, huge jaws full of teeth crammed in on one another. They looked at us. They looked at me with pale yellow eyes. I remembered Kasia telling me that the first cattle to fall sick had been wolf-bitten. The wolf in the lead was a little smaller than the rest. He sniffed the air towards me and then jerked his head sideways without ever taking his eyes off me. Two more came padding out of the trees. The pack spread out as if he had signaled them, fanning out to either side of me to block me in. They were hunting. They were hunting me. Kasia, I said. Kasia, go. Run now. With my heart stuttering, I dragged my arm out of her grip and fumbled in my bag. Kasia, go, I shouted, and I pulled the stopper and flung the stone potion at the lead wolf as he sprang. The gray mist rose up around him, and the great stone statue of a wolf fell like a boulder by my feet, the snarling jaws snapping at my ankle even as they stilled. One other wolf was caught in the edge of the mist, a wave of stone creeping more slowly over its body as it pawed the snow with its front feet for a moment, trying to escape. Kasia didn't run. She grabbed me by the arm and pulled me up and back towards the nearest house, Eva's house. The wolves howled with one terrible voice in protest, nosing cautiously at the two statues, and then one of them yelped and they fell in. They turned and came loping at us together. Kasia pulled us through the gate of Eva's front garden and slammed it. The wolves leapt the fence as lightly as springing deer. I didn't dare throw a fire heart with no protection against its spreading, not after what I'd seen that day. It would have burned all our village, and maybe all our valley, and certainly the two of us. I drew out the small green vial instead, hoping for enough destruction to get us inside the house. It grows grass, the dragon said dismissively when I'd asked. The warm, healthy color of it had looked friendly to me, like none of the other strange cold enchantments in his laboratory. And an inordinate number of wheat. It's useful only if you've had to burn a field clean. I thought I might use it after the fire heart to renew our grazing meadow. I wrenched open the stopper with shaking hands, and the potion spilled over my fingers. It smelled wonderful, good and clean and fresh, pleasantly sticky, like crushed grass and leaves in spring, full of juice, and I chewed it out of my cupped hands over the snow-bound garden. The wolves were running at us. Vines erupted like leaping snakes out of the dead vegetable beds, brilliant green, and flung themselves onto the wolves, wrapping thick coils around their legs and pulled them to the ground, scarcely inches away from us. Everything was suddenly growing like a year crammed into a minute. Beans and hops and pumpkins sprawling out across the ground and growing absurdly huge. They blocked the way towards us, even while the wolves fought and snapped and tore at them. The vines kept growing even larger, sprouting thorns the size of knives. One wolf was crushed in a swelling green twist, as thick around as a tree, and the pumpkin fell smashing onto another, so heavy it struck the wolf down to the ground as it burst. Kasia reached for me as I gawked, and I turned and stumbled on with her. The front door of the house wouldn't open, though Kasia wrenched on it. He turned for the small empty stable, really only a shelter for pigs, and slammed inside. There was no pitchfork there. It had been taken to the pens. The only thing left like a weapon was a small axe for chopping wood. I seized it in desperation while Kasia braced the door. The rest of the wolves had fought their way out of the bursting garden, and they were coming at us again. They reared up and clawed at the door, snapping at it, and then, ominously, they stopped. We heard them moving, and then one of them howled on the other side of the stable. outside the small high window. As we turned in alarm, three of them came flowing through it, one after another leaping. And others howled back on the other side of the door. I was empty. I tried to think of any charm, any spell I'd been taught, anything that might help against them. Maybe the potion had renewed me, like the garden, or else panic had done it. I didn't feel fainting weak any longer, and I could imagine casting some spell again, if I could only have thought of one that would be of any use. I wondered wildly whether Vanastalem could summon up armor. And then I said, Rautalem? Groping, muddling it up with a spell for sharpening kitchen knives, as I grabbed up the old water dish made of battered tin. I had no very good idea what it would do, but I hoped. Perhaps the magic was trying to save me and itself, because the dish flattened out and turned into an enormous shield of heavy steel. Kasha and I crouched behind it into a corner as the wolves leaped for us. She grabbed the axe from me and chopped at their claws and muzzles as they scrabbled around the edges, trying to tear it down or away from us. We were both hanging onto the shield's handles for life, desperate. And then, to my horror, one of the wolves, a wolf, went deliberately to the barred door of the stable, and with its nose, it nudged the bar up and open. The rest of the pack crowded in towards us. There was nowhere else to run. No trick left in my satchel. Kasha and I clung to each other, held on to our shield, and then abruptly, the entire wall of the shed ripped away from behind us. We fell backwards into the snow at the dragon's feet. The wolf pack leapt for him as one, howling, but he raised a hand and sang out a long, impossible line without a pause for breath. All at the same time, the wolves broke, in mid-air, a dreadful sound like snapping twigs. They fell huddled dead into the snow. Kasha and I were still clinging to each other as the wolf corpses thumped down around us one after another. We stared up at him, and he glared down at me, stiff and furious, and snarled. Of all the idiotic things you might have done, you monstrously half-witted lunatic of a girl! Look out! Kasha cried, too late. One last limping wolf, its fur stained orange with pumpkin, flung itself over the garden wall, and though the dragon snapped out a spell even as he turned, the beast caught his arm with one raking claw as it fell dying. Three bright drops of blood stained the snow crimson at his feet. He sank to his knees, gripping his arm at the elbow. The black wool of his jerkin was torn and gaping. His flesh was already turning green with corruption around the scratch. The color halted where his fingers gripped the arm, a faint glow of light limning his fingers, but the veins of his forearm were swelling. I fumbled for the elixir in my satchel. "Pour it on," he said with clenched teeth, when I would have given it to him to drink. I poured the liquid on, all of us holding our breath, but the black stain didn't recede. It only stopped spreading as quickly. "The tower," he said. Sweat had sprung out across his forehead. His jaw was locked almost beyond speech. "Listen. Jokonen valisu. Akanesh hinisu. Kozonen valisu." I stared. He couldn't mean to trust me to do it, to spell us back. But he didn't say anything else. All his strength was too plainly going to hold back the corruption. And I remembered, too late, what he'd told me. How if the wood had taken me, untrained and useless witch though I was, it could have made some truly dreadful horror out of me. What would it make of him? The foremost wizard of the realm. I turned to Kasha, and dug out the bottle of fire heart, and pressed it into her hands. "Tell Danka she has to send someone to the tower," I said, flat and desperate. "If we don't both come out and say everything's all right, if there is any doubt, burn it to the ground. Her eyes were full of worry for me, but she nodded. I turned to the dragon and knelt in the snow beside him. Good, he said to me very briefly, with a quick dart of his eyes towards Kasha. I knew then that my worst fears weren't wrong. I gripped his arm and closed my eyes and thought of the tower room. I spoke the words of the spell. Chapter 6. I helped the dragon stagger down the hall, the short distance to my small bedroom, the rope of silk dresses still dangling out the window. There was no hope of getting him down to his own room. He was dead weight, even as I lowered him to the bed. He was still gripping his arm, holding back the corruption somehow, but the glow about his hand was growing even fainter. I eased him back on the pillows and stood anxiously hovering over him a moment, waiting for him to say something, to tell me what to do. But he didn't speak. His eyes saw nothing, fixed on the ceiling. The small scratch had swollen up like the worst kind of spider bite. He was breathing in quick pants, and his forearm below where he gripped it was all that dreadful sickly green, the same color that had stained Yerzi's skin. The fingernails at the end of his hand were blackening. I ran down to the library, skidding down the steps, badly enough to scrape my shin bloody. I didn't even feel it. The books stood in their neat, elegant rows as always, placid and untroubled by my need. Some of them had become familiar to me by now. Old enemies, I would have called them, full of charms and incantations that would invariably go wrong inside my mouth, their very pages tingling unpleasantly when I touched the parchment. I went up the ladder and pulled them off the shelves anyway. Opened them one after another, paging through lists, all for nothing. The distillation of essence of myrtle might be highly useful in all sorts of workings, but it wouldn't do me any good now. And it was enraging to spend even a moment looking at six recipes for forming a proper seal upon a potion bottle. But the uselessness of the effort slowed me long enough to let me think a little better. I realized I couldn't hope to find the answer to something this dreadful in the spell books he had tried to teach me from. As he told me himself repeatedly, they were full of cantrips and trivialities, things that any witling wizard should have been able to master almost at once. I looked uncertainly at the lower shelves, where he kept the volumes he read himself, and which he had strangely warned me away from. Some were bound in new unbroken leather, tooled in gold. Some were old and nearly crumbling, some tall as the length of my arm, others small enough for the palm of my hand. I ran my hands over them, and on impulse pulled out a smaller one that bristled with inserted sheets of paper. It had a worn smooth cover and plain stamped letters. It was a journal, written in a tiny crabbed hand, almost impossible to read at first, and full of abbreviations. The sheets were notes in the dragon's hand, one or more of them inserted between almost every leaf, where he had written out different ways to cast each spell, with explanations of what he was doing. That at least seemed more promising, as if his voice might speak to me from the paper. There were a dozen spells for healing and for cleansing wounds, of sickness and gangrene, not of enchanted corruption, but at least worth the trying. I read over one spell which advised lancing the poisoned wound, packing it with rosemary and lemon peel, and doing something which the writer called putting breath on it. The dragon had written four crammed close pages on the subject, and drawn up lines in which he noted down nearly five dozen variations. This much rosemary, dry or fresh, that much lemon, with pith on or without, a steel knife, an iron one, this incantation and another. He hadn't written down which of the attempts had worked better and which worse, but if he had gone to so much effort, it had to be good for something. All I needed right now was to do him enough good to let him speak even a handful of words to me, give me some direction. I flew down to the kitchens and found a great bundle of hanging rosemary and a lemon. I took a clean paring knife and some fresh linens and hot water in a pot. Then I hesitated. My eye had fallen on the great cleaver, lying on its chopping stone. If I couldn't do anything else, if I couldn't give him the strength to speak, I didn't know if I could do it, if I could cut off his arm. But I saw Jerzy on his bed, cackling and monstrous, far away from the quiet, sad man who had always nodded to me in the lane. I saw Christina's hollowed-out face. I swallowed and picked up the cleaver. I honed both the knives, resolutely thinking of nothing, and then I carried my things upstairs. The window and door stood open, but even so, the terrible stink of corruption had begun to gather in my small room. It turned my stomach with dread, as much as physically. I didn't think I could bear to see the dragon corrupted. All his crisp edges rotted away, his sharp tongue reduced to howling and snarls. His breath was coming shorter, and his eyes were half closed. His face was terribly pale. I laid the linens under his arm and tied them on with some twine. I peeled off wide strips of the lemon skin, tore rosemary leaves off the stems, crushing them all and throwing them into the hot water so that the sweet strong smell rose up and drove out the stink. Then I bit my lip and, steeling myself, slashed open the swollen wound with the paring knife. Green tarry bile spurted out of it. I poured cup after cup of the hot water over the wound until it was clean. I caught fistfuls of the steep herbs and lemon and packed them down tight. The dragon's notes said nothing of what it meant to put breath on the wound. So I bent down and breathed out the incantations over it, trying one and then another, my voice breaking. They all felt wrong in my mouth, awkward and hard-edged, and nothing was happening. Wretched, I looked back at the crabbed original writing again. There was a line that said, "Kai and Tihas, sung as seems good, will have a special virtue." The dragon's incantations all had variants of those syllables, but strung round with others, built up into long, elaborate phrases that tangled on my tongue. Instead, I bent down and sang, "Tihas, Tihas, Kai Tihas, Kai Tihas," over and over, and found myself falling into the sound of the birthday song about living 100 years. That sounds absurd, but the rhythm of it was easy and familiar, comforting. I stopped having to think about the words. They filled my mouth and spilled over like water out of a cup. I forgot to remember Jerzy's mad laughter and the green vile cloud that had drowned the light inside him. There was only the easy movement of the song, the memory of faces gathered around the table laughing. And then finally, the magic flowed. But not the same way as when the dragon's spell lessons dragged it in a rush out of me. Instead, it seemed to me the sound of the chanting became a stream made to carry magic along, and I was standing by the water's edge with a pitcher that never ran dry, pouring a thin silver line into the rushing current. Under my hands, the sweet fragrance of rosemary and lemon was rising strong, overpowering the stench of corruption. More and more of the bile began to flow from the wound, until I would have worried, except that the dragon's arm kept looking better. The dreadful greenish cast was fading, the darkened and swollen veins shrinking back. I was running out of breath, but besides that, I felt somehow that I was finished, that my work was done. I brought my chanting to a simple close, going up and down the note. I had only really been humming anyway by the end. The shining glow where he held his arm at the elbow was growing stronger now, brighter, and abruptly thin lines of light shot away from his grip, running down his veins and spreading out through them like branches. The rot was disappearing. The flesh looked healthy. His skin restored to his usual unhealthy sunless pallor, but nevertheless his own. I watched it, holding my breath, hardly daring to hope. And then, his whole body shifted. He drew one longer, deeper breath, blinking at the ceiling with eyes that were aware again. And his fingers, one after another, let go their iron grip around his elbow. I could have sobbed with relief. Incredulous and hopeful, I looked up at his face, a smile working its way onto my mouth, and found him staring at me with an expression of astonished outrage. He struggled up from the pillows. He stripped his arm clean of the rosemary and lemon packing and held it in his fist with a look of incredulity, then leaned over and seized the tiny journal from the coverlet over his legs. I had put it there so I could look at it while I worked. He stared at the spell, turned the book to see the spine as if he didn't quite believe his own eyes, and then he spluttered at me. "You impossible, wretched, nonsensical contradiction! What on earth have you done now?" I sat back on my heels in some indignation. "This? When I had just saved not only his life, but everything he might be, and all the kingdom from whatever the wood might have made from him. What ought I have done?" I demanded. "And how was I to know to do it? Besides, it worked, didn't it?" For some reason, this only made him nearly incoherent with fury, and he levered himself up from my cot, threw the book across the room, all the notes flying everywhere, and flung himself out into the hallway without another word. "You might thank me," I shouted after him, outraged myself, and his footsteps had vanished before I recalled that he had been wounded at all in saving my life, that he had surely pressed himself to terrible lengths to come to my aid at all. That thought only made me feel more sulky, of course. So too did the slugging work of cleaning my poor little room and changing my bed. The stains wouldn't come out, and everything smelled foul, though without the terrible wrongness. Finally, I decided, for this, I would use magic after all. I began to use one of the charms the dragon had taught me, but then I instead went and dug up the journal from the corner. I was grateful to that little book and the past wizard or witch who had written it, even if the dragon wasn't to me. And I was happy to find, near the beginning, a charm for freshening a room. "Tishta, sung up and down, with work to show the way." I warbled it half in my head, while I turned out all the damp, stained ticking. The air grew cold and crisp around me, but without any unpleasant bite. By the time I had finished, the bedclothes were clean and bright, as though they were new washed, and my ticking smelled like it was fresh from a summer haystack. I assembled my bed again, and then I sat down upon it very heavily, almost surprised, as the last dregs of desperation left me, and with them all my strength. I fell down on the bed and barely managed to drag my coverlet over me before I slept. I woke slowly, peacefully, serenely, with sunlight coming in the window over me, and only gradually became aware that the dragon was in my room. He was sitting by the window, in the small work chair, glaring at me. I sat up and rubbed my eyes and glared back. He held up the tiny book in his hand. "What made you pick this up?" he demanded. "It was full of notes," I said. "I thought it must be important."
"It is not important," he said, although for how angry he seemed over it, I didn't believe him. "It is useless. It has been useless for all 500 years since it was written, and a century of study has not made it anything other than useless." "Well, it wasn't useless today," I said, folding my arms across my chest. "How did you know how much rosemary to use?" he said. "How much lemon?" You used all sorts of amounts in those tables, I said. I supposed it didn't much matter. The tables are of failures, you blundering imbecile, he shouted. None of them had the least effect, not in any parts, not in any admixture, not with any incantation. What did you do? I stared at him. I used enough to make a nice smell, and steeped them to make it stronger, and I used the chant on the page. There is no incantation here, he said. Two trivial syllables with no power. When I sang it long enough, it made the magic flow, I said. I sang it to many years, I added. He went even more red and indignant. He spent the next hour interrogating me as to every particular of how I had cast the spell, growing ever more upset. I could scarcely answer any of his questions. He wanted exact syllables and repetitions. He wanted to know how close I had been to his arm. He wanted the number of rosemary twigs and the number of pills. I did my best to tell him, but I felt, even as I did so, that it was all wrong, and finally I blurted out, as he wrote angrily on his sheets, "But none of that matters at all." His head raised to stare balefully at me, but I said, incoherent yet convinced, "It's just a way to go." "There isn't only one way to go," I waved at his notes. "You're trying to find a road where there isn't one. It's like it's gleaning in the woods," I said abruptly. "You have to pick your way through the thickets and the trees, and it's different every time." I finished triumphantly, pleased to have found an explanation which felt so satisfyingly clear. He only flung down his pen and slumped angrily back in his chair. "That's nonsense," he said, almost plaintively, and then stared down at his own arm with an air of frustration, as though he would rather have the corruption back instead of having to consider that he might be wrong. He glared at me when I said as much. I was beginning to be in something of a temper by then myself, thirsty and ravenously hungry, still wearing Christina's ragged homespun dress that hung off my shoulders and didn't keep me warm. Fed up, I stood, ignoring his expression, and announced, "I am going down to the kitchen." "Fine," he snapped, and stormed off to his library. But he couldn't bear an unanswered question. Before my chicken soup had even finished cooking, he appeared at the kitchen table again, carrying a new volume of pale blue leather tooled in silver, large and elegant. He set it down on the table next to the chopping block and said firmly, "Of course. It's that you've an affinity for healing, and it led you to intuit the true spell, even though you can't remember the particulars accurately anymore. That would explain your general incompetence. Healing is a particularly distinct branch of the magical arts. I expect you will progress considerably better going forward, once we devote our attention to the healing disciplines. We'll begin with Groshno's Minor Charms." He lay a hand on the tome. "Not until I've eaten lunch, we won't," I said, not posing. I was chopping carrots. He muttered something under his breath about recalcitrant idiots. I ignored him. He was happy enough to sit down and to eat the soup when I gave him a bowl with a thick slice of peasant bread that I'd made. The day before yesterday, I realized, I had only been out of the tower for a day and a night. It seemed a thousand years. "What happened with the chimera?" I asked around my spoon as I ate. "Vladimir's not a fool, thankfully," the dragon said, wiping his mouth with a conjured napkin. It took me a moment to realize he was speaking of the Baron. "After he sent his messenger, he baited the thing close to the border by staking out calves and having his pikemen harry it from every other direction. He lost 10 of them, but he managed to get it, not an hour's ride from the mountain pass. I was able to kill it quickly. It was only a small one, scarcely the size of a pony." He sounded strangely grim about it. "Surely that's good?" I said. He looked at me in annoyance. It was a trap, he bit out, as though that was obvious to any sensible person. I was meant to be kept away until the corruption had overrun all of Dvernik and worn down before I came. He looked down at his arm, opening and closing his fist. He changed his shirt for one of green wool, clasped with gold at the wrist. It covered his arm. I wondered if there were a scar beneath. Then, I ventured, I did well to go. His expression was as sour as milk left out in midsummer. If anyone could say so, when you've poured out 50 years worth of my most valuable potions in less than a day. Did it never occur to you that if they could be so easily spent, I would give a half a dozen flasks to every village headman and save myself the trouble of ever setting foot in the valley? They can't be worth more than people's lives, I fired back. A life before you in the moment isn't worth 100 elsewhere 3 months from now, he said. Listen, you simpleton, I have one bottle of Fireheart in the refining now. I began it 6 years ago, when the king could afford to give me the gold for it, and it will be finished in another 4. If we spend all my supply before then, do you suppose Rosia will generously refrain from firing our fields, knowing that we'll have starved and sued for peace before we can return the favor? And there are likewise costs for every other vial you spend. All the more because Rosia has 3 master wizards who can brew potions to our 2. But we are not at war, I protested. We will be in the spring, he said, if they hear a song of Fireheart and Stoneskin and profligacy and think they might have gained a real advantage. He paused and then he added heavily, or if they hear a song of a healer strong enough to purge corruption and think that soon the balance will tip in our favor instead, when you are trained. I swallowed and looked down at my bowl of soup. It was unreal when he spoke of Rosia declaring war because of me, because of things I'd done or what they would imagine I might do. But I remembered again the terror I'd felt on seeing the beacons lit with him gone, knowing just how little I could do to help those I loved. I still wasn't at all sorry to have taken the potions, but I couldn't pretend anymore that it mattered nothing whether I ever learned a single spell. Do you think I could help Jerzy once I've been trained? I asked him. Help a man already fully corrupted? The dragon scowled at me. But then he said, a grudging admission, you shouldn't have been able to help me. I picked up my bowl and drank the rest of the soup down, and then I put it aside and looked at him across the scarred and pitted kitchen table. All right, I said grimly. Let's get on with it. Unfortunately, the willingness to learn magic wasn't the same thing as being any good at it. Groshno's minor charms stymied me thoroughly, and the conjurations of Metradora remained resolutely unconjured. After another 3 days of letting the dragon set me at healing spells, all of which felt as awkward and wrong as ever, I marched down to the library the next morning with a little worn journal in my hand and put it down on the table before him as he scowled. "Why won't you teach me from this?" I demanded. "Because it's unteachable," he snapped. "I've barely managed to codify the simplest cantrips into any usable form, and none of the higher workings. Whatever her notoriety, in practice, it's worth almost nothing." "What do you mean, notoriety?" I said, and then I looked down at the book. "Who wrote this?" He scowled at me. "Yaga," he said, and for a moment, I stood cold and still. Old Yaga had died a long time ago, but there weren't very many songs about her, and bards mostly sang them warily, only in summer, at midday. She had been dead and buried 500 years, but that hadn't stopped her turning up in Rosia only 40 years ago, at the baptism of the newborn prince. She'd turned
Six guards who tried to stop her into toads put two other wizards to sleep. Then she'd gone over to the baby and peered frowning down at him. Then she'd straightened up and announced in irritation, "I've fallen out of time," before vanishing in a great cloud of smoke. So being dead wasn't a bar to her sudden return to claim her spellbook back, but the dragon only grew even more annoyed at my expression. "Stop looking like a solemn six-year-old. Contrary to popular imagination, she is dead, and whatever time wandering she may have done beforehand, I assure you she would have had a larger purpose than to run around eavesdropping on gossip about herself. As for that book, I spent an inordinate amount of money and trouble to get it, and congratulated myself on the acquisition, until I realized how infuriatingly incomplete it was. She plainly used it only to jog her memory. It has no details of real spell work." "The four I've tried have all worked perfectly well," I said, and he stared at me. He didn't believe me until he'd made me throw half a dozen of Yaga's spells. They were all alike. A few words, a few gestures, a few bits of herbs and things. No particular piece mattered. There was no strict order to the incantations. I did see why he called her spells unteachable, because I couldn't even remember what I did when I cast them, much less explain why I did any one step. But for me, they were an inexpressible relief after all the stiff, overcomplicated spells he'd set me. My first description held true. I felt as though I was picking my way through a bit of forest that I had never seen before, and her words were like another experienced gleaner somewhere ahead of me calling back to say, "There are blueberries down on the northern slope," or "Good mushrooms by the birches over here," or "There is an easy way through the brambles on the left." She didn't care how I got to the blueberries. She only pointed me in the proper direction and let me wander my way over to them, feeling out the ground beneath my feet. He hated it so very much, I almost felt sorry for him. He finally resorted to standing over me while I cast the final spell, noting down every small thing I did, even the sneeze from breathing in too deep over the cinnamon. And when I was finished, he tried it again himself. It was very strange watching him, like a delayed and flattering mirror. He did everything exactly the way I had done, but more gracefully, with perfect precision, enunciating every syllable I had slurred. But he wasn't halfway through before I could tell it wasn't working. I twitched to interrupt him. He shot me a furious look, so I gave up and let him finish working himself into a thicket as I thought of it. And when he was done, and nothing whatsoever had happened, I said, "You shouldn't have said Miko there." "You did," he snapped. I shrugged helplessly. I didn't doubt that I had, though, to be perfectly honest, I didn't remember. But it hadn't been an important thing to remember. "It was all right when I did it," I said, "but when you did it, it was wrong. As though you were following a trail, but a tree had fallen down in the meantime, or some hedge grew up, and you insisted on continuing on anyway, instead of going around it."
"There are no hedges," he roared.
"It comes, I suppose," I said thoughtfully, speaking to the air, "of spending too much time alone indoors, and forgetting that living things don't always stay where you put them." He ordered me from the room in stiff fury. I must give him this credit. He sulked for the rest of the week, and then he dug out a small collection of other spellbooks from his shelves, dusty and unused, full of untidy spells like the ones in Yaga's book. They all came to my hands like eager friends. He picked through them and consulted dozens of references in his other books, and with that knowledge laid out a course of study and practice for me. He warned me of all the dangers of higher workings, of the spell slipping out of your hands midway and thrashing around wild, of losing yourself in magic, and wandering through it like a dream you could touch, while your body dies of thirst, of attempting a spell past your limits, and having it drained any strength you didn't have. Though he still couldn't understand how the spells that suited me worked at all, he made himself a ferocious critic of my results, and demanded that I tell him beforehand what I meant to happen, and when I couldn't properly predict the outcome, he forced me to work that same spell over and over again until I could. In short, he tried to teach me as best he could, and to advise me in my blundering through my new forest, though it was foreign country to him. He did still resent my success, not from jealousy, but as a matter of principle. It offended his sense of the proper order of things that my slapdash workings did work, and he scowled as much when I was doing well as when I had made some evident mistake. A month into my new training, he was glaring at me while I struggled to make an illusion of a flower. "I don't understand," I said, whined. If I tell the truth, it was absurdly difficult. My first three attempts had looked like they were made of cotton rags. Now I had managed to put together a tolerably convincing wild rose, as long as you didn't try to smell it. "It's far easier just to grow a flower. Why would anyone bother?" "It's a matter of scale," he said. "I assure you, it is considerably easier to produce the illusion of an army than the real thing." "How is that even working?" he burst out, as he sometimes did when pressed past his limits by the obvious dreadfulness of my magic. "You aren't maintaining the spell at all. No chanting, no gesture?" "I'm still giving it magic. A great deal of magic," I added unhappily. The first few spells that didn't yank magic out of me like pulling teeth had been so purely a relief that I had half thought that the worst of it was over. Now that I understood how magic ought to work, whatever the dragon said on the subject, everything would be easy. Well, I soon learned better. Desperation and terror had fueled my first working, and my next few attempts had been the equivalent of the first cantrips he tried to teach me, the little spells he had expected me to master effortlessly. So I had indeed mastered those effortlessly, and then he had unmercifully set me a real spells, and everything had once again become, if not unbearable in the same way, at least exceedingly difficult.
"How are you giving it magic?" he said through his teeth.
"I already found the path," I said. "I'm just staying on it. Can't you feel it?" I asked abruptly and held my hand cupping the flower out towards him. He frowned and put his hands around it, and then he said, "Vadiya Rusha Ilika Tihi." And the second illusion laid itself over mine, two roses in the same space. His, predictably, had three rings of perfect petals and a delicate fragrance.
"Try and match it," he said absently, his fingers moving slightly, and by lurching steps we brought our illusions closer together until it was nearly impossible to tell them one from another. And then he said, "Ah!"
Suddenly, just as I began to glimpse his spell, almost exactly like that strange clockwork on the middle of his table, all shining moving parts. On an impulse, I tried to align our workings. I envisioned his like the water wheel of a mill, and mine the rushing stream driving it around.
"What are you..."
he began, and then abruptly, we had only one single rose, and it began to grow. And not only the rose, vines were climbing up the bookshelves in every direction, twining themselves around ancient tomes and reaching out the window. The tall slender columns that made the arch of the doorway were lost among rising birches, spreading out long finger branches. Moss and violets were springing up across the floor, delicate ferns unfurling. Flowers were blooming everywhere, flowers I had never seen. Strange blooms dangling, and others with sharp points, brilliantly colored, and the room was thick with their fragrance, with the smell of crushed leaves and pungent herbs. I looked around myself alight with wonder, my magic still flowing easily. "Is this what you meant?" I asked him. It really wasn't any more difficult than making the single flower had been. But he was staring at the riot of flowers all around us, as astonished as I was. He looked at me, baffled, and for the first time uncertain, as though he had stumbled into something unprepared. His long, narrow hands were cradled around mine, both of us holding the rose together. Magic was singing in me, through me. I felt the murmur of his power singing back that same song. I was abruptly too hot and strangely conscious of myself. I pulled my hands free. Chapter 7. I avoided him all the next day stupidly, and realized too late that my success in doing so meant he had avoided me too, when he had never let me miss a lesson before. I didn't care to think why. I tried to pretend it meant nothing, that we had both simply wanted a holiday from my laborious training. But I passed a restless night and went down to the library the next morning, sandy-eyed and nervous. He didn't look at me as I came in. He said shortly, "Begin with Fulmkia, on page 43. A wholly different spell, and he kept his head bent over his own book. I gladly dived for the safety of my work. We lasted 4 days in near silence, and might have gone a month without exchanging more than a few words a day, I suppose, left to our own devices. But on the morning of the fourth day, a sledge drew up to the tower, and when I looked out of the window, it was Boris, but not alone. He was driving Kasha's mother, Wensa, and she was huddled small in a sleigh, her pale round face looking up at me from under her shawl. I hadn't seen anyone from Dvernik since the beacon night. Danka had sent the Fireheart back to Alshanka, with an escort gathered grimly from every village of the valley as it passed through with the message. They had come in force to the tower 4 days after I had transported the dragon and myself back. It was brave of them, farmers and craftsmen, coming to face a worse horror than any of us could even have imagined, and they had been wary of believing that the dragon was healed. The mayor of Alshanka had even had the courage to demand that the dragon show the wound to the town physician. He grudgingly obliged, rolling up his sleeve to show the faint white scar, all that was left of the wound, and even told the man to draw some blood from his fingertip. It sprang out clean red. But they had also brought the old priest in his full purple gown to say a blessing over him, which infuriated him to no end. "What on earth are you lending yourself to this nonsense for?" he demanded of the priest, whom he evidently knew a little. "I've let you shrive a dozen corrupted souls. Did any of them sprout the purple rose or suddenly announce themselves saved and purified? What possible good do you imagine saying a blessing over me would do if I were corrupted?" "So you are well, then," the priest had said dryly, and they at last allowed themselves to believe, and the mayor had handed over the Fireheart with great relief. But of course my father and brothers hadn't been allowed to come, nor had anyone from my village, who would have grieved to see me burn. And the man who had come, they'd look at me standing beside the dragon, and I didn't know how to name what was in their faces. I was back in comfortable plain skirts again, but they looked at me anyway as they went away. Not with hostility, but not in a way any of them would ever have looked at the woodcutter's girl from Dvernik. It was the way I had looked at Prince Marek at first. They looked at me and saw someone out of a story, who might ride by and be stared at, but didn't belong in their lives at all. I flinched from those looks. I was glad to go back into the tower. That was the day I had taken Yaga's book down to the library and demanded that the dragon stop pretending I had any more gift for healing than I did for any other sort of spell, and let me learn the kind of magic that I could do. I hadn't tried to write a letter even though I suppose the dragon would have let me send one. What would I say? I had gone home and had even saved it, but it wasn't my place anymore. I couldn't go and dance in a village square among my friends any more than 6 months ago I could have marched into the dragon's library and sat down at his table. When I saw Wences's face, though, even from the library window, I didn't think of any of that. I left my working, hanging in the air, unfinished, as he'd so often ordered me never to do, and flung myself down the stairs. He shouted after me, but his voice couldn't reach me, because Wences wouldn't be here if Kasha could have come. I jumped down the last few steps into the great hall, and at the door I halted only a moment. Irinar! Irinar! I cried. It was only a charm for untying snarled knots of thread, and slurred besides, but I flung profligate magic behind it, as though I determined to hack my way through a thicket with an axe instead of taking the time to find my way around. The doors jumped as if startled, and opened for me. I fell through them onto suddenly weak knees, as the dragon delighted in telling me, caustically, there was good reason that the more powerful spells were also the more complicated. But I staggered up and caught Wences's hands as she raised them to knock. Her face in close was wrung with weeping. Her hair was hanging down her back, clouds of it pulling out of the long thick plait, and her clothing was torn and stained with dirt. She was wearing her night shift and a smog flung over it. "Nieshka," she said, gripping my hands too hard, strangling the feeling out of them and her nails digging into my skin. "Nieshka, I had to come." "Tell me," I said. "They took her this morning, when she went for water," Wences said. "Three of them, three walkers." Her voice breaking. It was a bad spring when even one of the walkers came out of the wood and went plucking people out of the forest like fruit. I'd seen one once, a long way off through the trees, like an enormous twig insect, at once almost impossible to see among the underbrush, and jointed wrong and dreadful. So when it moved, I had shuddered back from it, queasy. They had arms and legs like branches, with long, twiggy, stalk fingers, and they would pick their way through the woods and find places near footpaths and near water, near clearings, and wait in silence. If someone came in arm's reach, there was no saving them, unless you had a great many men with axes and fire nearby. When I was 12, they caught one half a mile past Zatochek, the tiny village that was the last in the valley, the last before the wood. The walker had taken the child, a little boy, bringing a pail of water to his mother for the washing. She'd seen him snatched and screamed. There had been enough women nearby to raise the alarm and slow it down. They had halted it at last with fire, but it had still been a day's work to hack it to pieces. The walker broke the child's arm and legs where it gripped it, and never let go until they finally cut through the trunk of its body and severed the limbs. Even then, it took three strong men to break the fingers of the boy's body, and he had scars around his arms and legs, patterned like the bark of an oak tree. Those the walkers carried into the wood were less lucky. We didn't know what happened to them, but they came back out sometimes corrupted in the worst way, smiling and cheerful, unharmed. They seemed almost themselves to anyone who didn't know them well, and you might spend half a day talking with one of them and never realize anything was wrong, until you found yourself taking up a knife and cutting off your own hand, putting out your own eyes, your own tongue, while they kept talking all the while smiling, horrible. And then they would take the knife and go inside your house to your children, while you lay outside blind and choking and helpless even to scream. If someone we loved was staking by the walkers, the only thing we knew to hope for them was death. And it could only be hope. We could never know for certain until one of them came out and proved they weren't dead, and then had to be hunted down. "Not Kasha," I said. Not Kasha.
Wensa had bent her head. She was weeping into my hands, which she still clenched on like iron.
Please, Neshka, please.
She spoke hoarsely, without hope. She would never have come to ask the dragon for help. I knew. She would have known better. But she had come to me. She couldn't stop weeping. I brought her inside, into the small entry hall, and the dragon, impatiently, stalked into the room and held her out a draught, though she shrunk from him and hid her face until I gave it to her. She relaxed heavily almost as soon as she had drunk it, and her face smoothed. She let me help her upstairs to my own little room, and she lay down on the bed quietly, though with her eyes open. The dragon stood in the doorway watching us. I held up the locket from around Wensa's neck. She has a lock of Kasha's hair. I knew she'd cut it from Kasha's head the night before the choosing, thinking she would have nothing left to remember her daughter by. If I use Loitalal... He shook his head. What do you imagine you're going to find besides a smiling corpse? The girl is gone. He jerked his chin at Wensa, whose eyes had drifted shut. She'll be calmer after she sleeps. Tell that driver to come back in the morning to take her home. He turned and left. And the worst of it was how matter-of-factly he'd spoken. He hadn't snapped at me or called me a fool. He hadn't said the life of a village girl wasn't worth the chance the wood might take me to add to its host. He hadn't told me I was an idiot, drunk on success in throwing potions, in pulling flowers from the air, to suddenly think I could save someone the wood had taken. The girl is gone. He'd even sounded sorry in his abrupt way. I sat with Wensa, numb and cold, holding her hard, red, calloused hand in my lap. It was growing dark outside. If Kasha was still alive, she was in the wood, watching the sun go down, light dying through the leaves. How long did it take to hollow someone out from the inside? I thought of Kasha in the grip of the walkers, the long fingers curled around her arms and legs, knowing all the while what was happening, what would happen to her. I left Wensa sleeping and went downstairs to the library. The dragon was there, looking through one of the vast ledgers he made records in. I stood in the doorway staring at his back. I know you held her dear, he said over his shoulder, but there is no kindness in offering false hope. I didn't say anything. Yaga's book of spells was lying open on the table, small and worn. I'd been studying only spells of earth this week. Fulmkia, Fulmidesh, Fulmista. Solid and fixed, as far from the air and fire of illusion as magic could get. I took the book and slipped it into my pocket behind the dragon's back. And then I turned around and went silently down the stairs. Boris was still outside, waiting, his face long and bleak. He looked up from his blanketed horses when I came out of the tower. "Will you drive me to the wood?" I asked him. He nodded, and I climbed into his sleigh and drew the blankets around me as he made the horses ready again. He climbed aboard and spoke to them, jingling his reins, and the sleigh leapt out over the snow. The moon was high that night, full and beautiful, blue light on the shining snow all around. I opened Yaga's book as we flew and found a spell for the quickening of feet. I sang it softly to the horses, their ears pricking back to listen to me, and the wind of our passage grew muffled and thick, pressing hard on my cheeks and blurring my sight. The spindle, frozen over, was a pale silver road running alongside, and the shadow grew in the east ahead of us, grew and grew, until the horses, uneasy, slowed and came to a halt without any word or any movement of reins. The world stopped moving. We were stopped under a small ragged cluster of pine trees. The wood stood ahead of us, across an open stretch of unbroken snow. Once a year, when the ground thawed,
The dragon took all the unmarried men, older than 15, out to the borders of the wood. He burned a swath of ground along its edge bare and black, and the men followed his fire, sprinkling the ground with salt